available in more homes than the Pac-12 Network, we are the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online.
And here he goes, Miles Jack.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com.
Liner gonna try to sneak it ahead. Touchdown, SC!
We are the Podcast of Champions.
Welcome, everyone, back to the Podcast of Champions. I'm David Woods from Bruin Report Online, the UCLA site on the 24/7 Sports Network.
And I'm Ryan Abraham from USCFootball.com, the USC site on the 24/7 Sports Network. And together we make the Podcast of Champions, talking all things Pac-12 football. We got a packed show for you today. Lots of topics to get to, lots of questions to get to. Our great listeners out there flooding the email box for us, the inbox. I am unfortunately on the road. I don't have any of our sound today, David, but we'll have to do without it. But I would love to be playing the talk with the audience one, because we have a lot of talking to the audience going to happen today.
So much talking to the audience, perhaps too much, frankly.
So we get the intern to read the questions last week, and it was like the shortest mail, you know, smallest mailbox, shortest questions ever. That's not the case this week. So Bree, we need to Bree back, but I'm on the road, so we can't do that. If you want to get a hold of us and you want to flood that email box a little bit more, Pac-12podcast@gmail.com, or if you'd rather call or text us, 424-532-0678 is the number. You can also tweet us at Pac-12podcast. The website is Pac-12podcast.com. On the Reddit page, go to Podcast of Champions. And then also, please subscribe and rate us. 5 stars are awesome. We do appreciate that very much. It helps grow the show. And we keep growing every week, even though we're in a pandemic. And
exponential. No exponential growth.
I don't know about exponential growth.
Well, we started with one a week ago, and I think we have two now.
Okay. That would be exponential. Do we have any new reviews? I don't know if you've pulled those
we
up
do.
Or not.
We do. Are you ready for them?
Sure, yes.
This is from Da King of Swing 69, 5 stars. Love it. The Marty and Michael podcast rocks. Makes me laugh. 5 stars all day. Whoops, wrong podcast. Well, that's disappointing. I'll still give you 5 stars anyway. Dan and Robert are hilarious, especially in these tough times. Nick from Eugene and Sko Ducks.
Sko Duck, nice.
And then 5 stars from Free Taiwan 228, subject line, Taiwan Independence, 3 exclamation points, description, Taiwan Independence. Thanks. Love you guys. Love it. We're all about free billboard advertising. That's what we do here.
It doesn't seem like they were reviewing our podcast at all.
I'm fine with it. They said love you guys. I think that's a review.
But you know what's really important, David? They left us 5 stars, so it didn't break the rules.
The most important thing. We will read... pretty much, I mean, I scan them a little bit before I read them, but we will read pretty much anything you say that isn't hate speech in one of these reviews, as long as you give us 5 stars.
Should I feel like I need to get an iPhone, you know, like I've always liked Android. I like my Google phone, but I can't read the reviews unless I have my iPad with me, which I don't have. It's in the office. So I don't know. Should I switch?
I'm sorry that you have not cracked the code on finding this through a web browser, but I am not going to be the person who leads you to that.
You can do it. It's just not – it's way easier to do it if you're on an Apple device and you can see the stuff. But
it's true, but you can see all of the reviews a lot quicker on a computer. So that's what I would recommend. That's my little recommendation to you, the co-host.
Nice. All right. Well, maybe I'll check that out. Well, okay. So the title of the show today is sort of broke. Was it? I think it was almost a week ago now that, you know, the Pac-12 teaming up with a company called Quidel, they're going to be able to offer conference-wide daily rapid results testing for COVID-19. So what that would do is basically you could test all the athletes every day. You would know before they got into their meetings or went to the practice field if they had it or not. Huge as far as limiting the spread. You won't have asymptomatic people coming to practice and spreading around to a bunch of other people that could be asymptomatic and spread around to more people and bring it into the community and all that kind of stuff. So certainly limit the community the danger to the community of having players out on the practice field, and specifically for two states right now, David, can't practice, California and Oregon. But, you know, and it would also help with the research side to track the course of the infection in positive cases and learn about the behavior of the virus in asymptomatic cases, which, again, would be a benefit to all communities. So Larry Scott was extremely excited to talk about this. It was, you know, the first of the conferences to have anything like this. And, I, you know, another thing I think that the conference has handled well, you know, certainly positive news. He went on a, he had a, you know, one-on-one interview with 24/7 Sports. He's gone on all kinds of radio shows, Dan Patrick, all those kind of stuff. What did you make of all this? And do you feel like this can be the game changer that they're really touting that it could be?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of tracks along with the science that one of the main things you've got to do is test, and test in a useful way where you get results back quickly. That's kind of the one of the gold standard things that we'll need to get life back to normal. So it passes my smell test that this is something that could get sports back to normal in micro. So I think it's a really good thing. And it sounds as if it's going to be a factor in potentially starting football earlier than we were anticipating, you know, potentially starting this. It sounds like it's even possible it could happen before January 1st, but at the very least happening pretty much as soon as January hits. Now we'll see, because as much as you test, still the surrounding pandemic is going to dictate a lot. California's decisions are going to dictate a lot. And if we see an uptick in cases again, I mean, it looks like we're on another downward slope from the second peak. But if we see another uptick on the West Coast over the, you know, coming flu season, then that might change the story a little bit. But as of now, certainly more optimistic to get football in a reasonable time frame, thanks to this news.
Yeah, Larry Scott was saying, like, you know, he was really optimistic that you could start football by January, which would mean you're having camp, you know, late November, you know, through December. But there was also the possibility of having, you know, a post-Thanksgiving season. So again, I don't think it would be in time to join the party of the college football playoff unless, you know, the big, the Power Three conferences that are, you know, starting actually tonight. We're recording this on Thursday. I think it's Miami-Syracuse tonight. Like on ACC Network opposite Deshaun Watson versus Patrick Mahomes. So I don't know anyone's going to watch that. But technically, Power 5 football starts tonight, unless they get delayed somehow.
Yeah, I don't believe it will.
You don't think it will. But like, so you're talking about not making the playoff, but I think it's still meaningful to be able to play college football. It's a throwaway year as far as eligibility goes. It's not like you play football and it hurts anyone's eligibility. You would get some of those players that we're going to get, the guys that are opting out that are, you know, pretty surefire NFL kind of guys. There's a lot of people that need to prove themselves. You know, that Joe Burrow last year would not have been drafted if he didn't get to play. So I feel like it's important to get these kids an opportunity to play if you can do it safely. I think this, the rapid testing, the daily testing, seems to be able to do that. But for even Larry Scott to be like, hey, man, we feel we can definitely play in January and we might even be able to do it sooner, I think that's all positive. I think it's a, you know, it's a positive step, and I like the way the Pac-12 is doing it, saying like they're taking a very measured approach. The Big Ten is still a mess. I mean, the rumors that they could start in October just don't seem to make any sense at all. I don't know. I feel like at the end of the day, the Pac-12 and the Big Ten will link up, but I don't know if it's just for show or whatever. But the Big Ten's got people, like, you know, you got politicians involved. There's lawsuits. There's all kinds of crazy stuff going on over there.
Yeah, people, they're apparently really, really care about this. yeah, I think they will eventually link up. Maybe that'll require the Pac-12 bending and going a little bit earlier. Maybe it'll require the Big Ten, you know, actually coming out with some sort of definitive word. It certainly sounds as if the Big Ten is trying to get this done for the fall. I do not buy the October stuff, but potentially November or December. That is a more interesting prospect for the Big Ten due to obvious weather stuff, but certainly not insurmountable. I mean, there's a lot of domed stadiums in the area. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly looking more optimistic for getting a reasonable season in for both leagues. You know, it wasn't. It was a month ago that the Big Ten and Pac-12 more or less announced that they were postponing, and at that time it looked like, well, hell, they might not play at all until next fall. And who knows? This thing has changed so often over the last several months that it might very well look like that again in 1 month's time. But right now, it looks like, okay, it's reasonable to consider this actually happening sometime in the next couple of months, kicking off. And that's that's exciting news because, I mean, watching, well, not watching, actually, hearing that there were college football games this past weekend and knowing that there were zero games that I cared about was distressing. And so if I can, you know, distance my mind from everything else going on in the world and just say, man, it sucks that the Pac-12 isn't playing football right now, this is better news, right? Because it sounds like they will. And then I'll have games to watch because I exclusively watch Pac-12 football. I don't watch anything else. At all.
I like to watch all football, so I'm going to definitely watch the NFL
tonight. You must have loved that Navy BYU game.
I watched part of it. Unfortunately, it was already like, well, because I wanted to see some college football, more of just to see like what it looks and feels like without fans.
I watched like the pregame stuff, and the stadium was like, it was unnerving. It was like watching, you know, do you ever play like college football video games and stuff? And do like the like pregame show and whatever, and it's always like an empty stadium, like they don't like generate all the fans. That's what it felt like. Just it feels really weird watching. It feels like a simulation.
Well, also I don't know if you got the great John Canzano. You know, he does his radio show every week up in Oregon, and he had Dr. Doug Aukerman on. So he's like a senior associate athletic director at Oregon State, but also an expert in all this stuff. He's the head of their medical committee for the COVID response team, or I forget what the exact title is, something like that. But it's a really good interview. It's up on his podcast. You can listen to that. But the main takeaway from hearing what he had to say was that there was a lot of optimism in the state of Oregon that this rapid testing would allow, you know, the government in Oregon to say, okay, you can practice now. Because the whole point is, half of the Pac-12 can't have a regular practice as of right now. You know, Stanford, they had the weird rule where, you know, you couldn't snap the ball to the center. You know, in California, you can't, I mean, in LA County, you can't lift a weight indoors. Like, there's all these things that are going on that are not allowing these teams to practice. And, you know, the main one being you can't have gatherings of more than at least 12 people, I think, in California. But Dr. Aukerman was saying that, you know, he was optimistic that this rapid testing would allow them to be able to practice. And other places too, where you say, okay, well, you could practice in California as well. We don't know that for sure, but that's the first step to, if you want to play in, you know, after the first of the year, or you want to play after Thanksgiving, these teams have to be able to practice. And I know things are starting to open up in different counties in California. LA County is still pretty locked down. I saw commercials for, and I tweeted about this, Dave, I don't know if you saw, like, commercials for movies, like people saying go to the movie theater. I'm like, wait, you can go to the movie theater? Like, we can't even eat inside right now.
No, that's not the take from that. Come on. The take is, why the hell is anyone going to a movie right now? Like, okay, so like, wherever you are on the spectrum of like COVID being a serious thing or not, why the hell would you go to like an enclosed space with like poor like lighting, you can't see what you're touching, and poor ventilation, like it's stuffy. It's like, why would you do that? Why?
Yeah. I wasn't a big movie theater guy to begin with, but like, yeah, I'm not be going now. But I was just shocked to see those commercials. But it just shows that different counties, different states, obviously they're opening. But even in California, I mean, I've had people tweet me like in San Diego, they went to a movie. And so it depends which county you're in. But the thing will be, I got off topic there because that's what we do on the show. Would California and would Oregon be able to practice because of this rapid testing? And at least, according to Dr. Aukerman, on the Oregon side, it seems like that would open things up. And you're hopeful that it would in California too. And then once everyone could practice, then you could potentially have a fall camp and then you could start the season. But until all the teams were allowed to practice, it wasn't going to be possible.
Yeah, and if you get aggressive enough with the potential schedule and they do, and you know, say the Pac-12 and the Big Ten are able to start play in November? Who knows? It opens up possibilities to link up again with the other leagues and potentially participate in the college football playoff. I thought Stu Mandel had a good kind of column with, you know, it's a moonshot at this point because it's still not a guarantee that a lot of these states are going to open or that they're going to remain open. But as it stands, there's a sliver of a possibility that they could line up enough that the college football playoff, you know, kicks things back another week or two to allow for the other leagues to get enough games in to participate.
I thought that was interesting too. And I think I like the way I've heard the Pac-12 sort of talk about this is you would like to get a season in. If you don't make the, you know, if you're not going to be in the playoff race, that's fine. Like who, you know, Oregon, I guess, would have a shot at it this year, but we're going to talk about some of the guys they've had opt out. I don't know if the Pac-12 has a legit contender as of this moment. But, you know, who knows? That's why you have the playoffs and you play the games and it might happen. I get the Big Ten kind of complaining more because Ohio State was going to be the number two ranked team in the country. But for me, I would like to see a season. I do think there's some fans are just like, what does it matter? It's not important. Like, I think it's important. I think it's important to the players and the fans. I think it's important. But also, if you're with, you know, the Big Ten and you have your partner and you get to play the Rose Bowl and you get some other bowl games that you just, you know, the number two from each side, the number three from each side, it'd be kind of fun. It's like with those preseason, like, what was it, like the Big East ACC Challenge or whatever, things like that. It's sort of like a postseason version of that, but a seeded one, a ranked one, and, you know, with the number one game being the Rose Bowl. And because the eligibility doesn't matter, all the players get an extra year, you know, it's free football. And then you probably don't have to do spring practice because you're going to have been playing into, you know, February or March or whatever. So I love this. I wish the Big Ten would sort of just kind of back off things. But go for it. You know, go as fast as you can safely and see what happens. When can you start? Maybe it's not till January 1st. But even then, you're done in March. That's great. If you get to start after Thanksgiving, that's even better, you know. And maybe, like you said, with Stuart Mandel's column, you line up and they delay the playoff for a couple of weeks and you get in there or potentially get in there. You make All-American teams, all those kind of things, I think are positive. So I don't get the people that are saying like, oh, whatever, what even have a season now? It's so weird. It just seems like this defeatist attitude where I get it. It's a pandemic. Like this shit's crazy. Like we've never seen anything like this before. If you can make it work somehow, make it work.
Yeah, I totally agree. I would say there's an element where part of the season does feel maybe a little bit illegitimate just because so many guys have opted out, and we'll talk about the guys in Pac-12, but even just throughout the other leagues, I mean, LSU had, I don't know how many other star players just opt out of the season. Kennedy Brooks from Oklahoma opted out for the season. Like, there's a lot of guys from all these different leagues where I get from, like, a particular fan of a school standpoint, you feel like, oh, this season's now illegitimate. Like, if an Oregon fan is like, oh, this sucks now. Like, I'm gonna watch this season, but I'm gonna constantly have in the back of my head how much better they could have been if none of this had happened. And I get that. I think there's going to be, however the season plays out, there's going to be this melancholy feeling around it, and particularly if you're a diehard fan of a particular team that had a chance to be really good this year. And that's not to say Oregon or LSU or Oklahoma or whoever isn't going to be really good this year or doesn't still have a chance to be really good this year. But I get that. Like, I understand why that might make it, you might not be as amped up for a season as you would have been otherwise. And totally. Yeah. It's a weird, weird situation, but I think you're dead on. I think for the kids, mostly just for them, but also for fans, you know, people who, there is like a societal morale thing that I think comes from being able to watch things that, you know, you really enjoy. And a lot of people really enjoy everything about college football, the community feel of it, but also just the sport itself. And I think there is value to that. Now, does it come, is there enough value with that to, you know, compensate for potential, you know, issues with it, like, you know, if it does contribute to increasing cases or whatever? I don't think so, but it seems like that decision is getting made way above our pay grade. So from this standpoint, I do think it's potentially a good thing for the kids to actually get to do this, and for fans to have something to watch and enjoy. So, yeah, I mean, I understand if it gets a little bit weird and it sucks that it's not the season that everyone thought it was going to be, but it's football.
It's football. We love football. And there's some positivity of having some more football. Now, we don't know. I mean, obviously, if the season comes crashing down for all the teams that are playing now, that's all out the window, right? We're assuming that the ACC, the SEC, the Big 12, they go forward, they're playing football, and then it, you know, sort of proves out the concept, and you have the rapid testing, and you feel better about playing, so then you go ahead and can play if you're the Pac-12 and the Big 10. This is sort of like week two, but there still really hasn't been any legit games yet. Tonight, you know, they have
UAB a game Miami. With Miami.
It's UAB. It's not Syracuse. UAB Miami. And it's on the ACC network. This weekend, there's several games that were postponed. I think there's teams like Rice that haven't really been able to practice much. So there's going to be – it's not going to be smooth. There's going to be some hiccups. Maybe none of the SEC teams have hiccups, but there's going to be other teams that do. And for the ACC and the Big 12 that are playing an out-of-conference game, that's going to be impacted. You might lose your out-of-conference game because you're playing this team that probably doesn't have the resources that your conference does and can't do certain things. You know, Rice is, you know, they couldn't even practice very much. There's, you know, was it Tulane that had, because of the hurricane, it displaced all the players that were like on campus in their like little bubble thing. They all go spread out. And a whole bunch of them catch COVID, and then they come back, and there's like 38 people on the team that have COVID.
Yeah.
So, like, in an indirect way, like, the hurricane kind of caused the problem there. So there's going to be some hiccups. But now that we're going to start to see Power 5 teams play, what hiccups are they going to see? What if – it's a big difference between, like, Rice has a problem or Notre Dame has a problem. And Notre Dame's hosting Duke this year. So, I mean, this weekend. So – will you watch those? You're going to watch some of those and just to see how it works?
I doubt I'm going to watch a second of college football until the Pac-12 starts playing. Like, not even kidding. Like, I don't have much interest. I mean, the times I've, like, tuned into, like, an SEC game or an ACC game in the last, like, 3 years, you can probably fit it on the head of a pin. I mean, it's mostly like the early games on a Saturday where it's just like something to have on. But I got small kids. I'm not going to waste time doing that. The other thing that I thought was interesting is even if the Pac-12 was trying to play right now, there's a good chance a lot of the teams wouldn't be able to. Stanford and Cal probably wouldn't be able to practice. The Oregon schools probably wouldn't be able to practice. I don't know what's going on up in Washington as far as the fires, but throughout basically the entire West Coast right now, you'd have a lot of game cancellations for just this weekend alone. Because it's 2020 and we live in a dystopia. And it's very cool. But
I mean, the sky looks like it now. Like the sky here on the West Coast looks like it's dystopia. It looks like it's like Mad Max is going to pull up.
Well, and that's the thing is you're talking about the Tulane and the hurricane causing a lot of these indirect things. Well, if the Oregon players were on campus right now and they had to get evacuated out of their dorms or whatever, what would that lead to? And suddenly no longer a controlled environment. Now they have to, you know, be out in the wild. So, yeah, it could have easily happened. The Pac-12, I think, had, you know, they made their decision, a conservative decision to delay the whole thing, and it's, you know, kept them from that. But there's no discounting the fact that that could happen at any point. I mean, fire season now in on the West Coast lasts through like November. So yeah, I mean, there's always a possibility that something weird happens. So it'll be a really weird season.
For sure. I was listening to Canzano too. And they said the air quality around Eugene was like the worst in the world. It was like yesterday, I believe, like on Wednesday, essentially. And then they said that if Oregon, Ohio State, which was supposed to be this weekend, would have been canceled anyway. Like they wouldn't have been played even if it wasn't for the pandemic, just because of the fire. So that's peak 2020. Peak 2020 right there, man. It's like hard to believe that would be going on, but there we are. John Wilner also had an interview with Michael Shill, so the president of the University of Oregon. He's the chair of the CEO group for the Pac-12. So all the presidents and chancellors of the Pac-12 schools. He sent them. It wasn't like a sit-down interview. It was an email interview. But there was some interesting stuff that came out. Go check it out. Go check out the John Wilner's hotline. But there was more asking about the future of the Pac-12, and it seemed like he was open to the idea that it could change from a conference/media company to back to a conference again. And the quote was, they need to find partners that would add to the value of our content. So they seemed to be open to that. He wasn't commenting about Larry Scott's contract at all. That's going to come up at some point, but I think they're aware that there's some issues there. But I don't know. Go check that out from John Wilner's Q&A. But we're going to know more in the next couple of years for sure about the future of this conference. And they have to make some changes because you can't just keep going the way you're going. Partner up with ESPN, Fox, whatever it is. Dump the six regional networks. Just have a Pac-12 network. Whatever you got to do, it's not working in this situation. You got to fix it. And, I know it's great to show 800 live events a year, but that doesn't make you any money. And there's probably no point in it now.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of that stuff can just be handled via live streaming by the school's media department or whatever. The same 500 people are going to watch it, whether it's on a computer live stream or on the TV. So you don't need to do that. We've alluded to it several times, but a bunch of guys have opted out for the season. Oregon has been hit maybe the most notably with Thomas Graham, Penei Sewell, and D'Amador Lenore, which is the first time I've pronounced his last name correctly on this show. Maybe the last time I say his name on this show, Lenore. Not Lenoir. I want to say Lenoir every time. You know it. You know that about me. But I said it correctly this time. They have decided to opt out. They're going to the NFL draft. Graham and Lenore, obviously defensive backs out of that vaunted secondary. Sewell may be the best offensive lineman in the country. Not great for Oregon. They've certainly recruited well and should be able to replace them in time. But not great for the top end potential of that team this year, if and when a season gets played. USC, Elijah Vera Tucker, offensive lineman, he opted out. That's a big blow to an offensive line that was, trying to piece things together for this year. And then Cal lost fifth-year senior cornerback Cam Bynum, who also opted out for the NFL draft out of that vaunted secondary. Just now, I believe this news just came out that Walker Little from Stanford has also opted out.
Oh, I didn't see that one yet. Okay.
Yep. So real significant amount of opt-outs now. Transfers didn't hit that hard in the Pac-12. They hit a little bit, but they didn't hit that hard. But the opt-outs are a big deal. They're happening all over. I don't know if many players have opted out just specifically for COVID. That was happening a little bit earlier on in the summer, but I don't think that's happening anymore. But a lot of these guys are opting out for the NFL. I don't blame them, but it is going to lead to a lessened season in a lot of respects.
Yeah. One notable transfer, just because we talked about it before, Cassidy Woods, the receiver from Washington State. He had that scrutinized phone call with Nick Rolovich. Well, he's in the transfer portal now, so that relationship didn't start off on a good note, so it makes sense that it would end. But
in the position where you're recording your head coach on a phone call, whatever your whatever the legitimacy of your beef, and I think he may have had one, that's not the beginning of a trusting and long-lasting relationship.
No, not so much. But for the opt-outs, it was weird. So Penei Sewell was this week. For some reason, I thought he had already opted out, or just maybe assumed he was going to. But it's a pretty big blow to the Oregon secondary. Thomas Graham started since he was a freshman there. For USC, Elijah Vera Tucker is certainly their best offensive lineman. He was a left guard last year that was PFF. They loved him. They kept grading him out as the highest, the top guard in the Pac-12 and one of the best in the country. And USC didn't have a replacement at left tackle, so they were going to move him out there. So he was going to be playing out of position anyway, but certainly their best guy. Now it's basically two holes. You lost your left guard and your left tackle if you're USC, so there's going to be some issues there. And, you know, Cal's defensive stuff, but, you know, Cam Bynum was a real good player too. I think he's graduating, he could potentially play somewhere else right away. So curious if he goes someplace that's actually playing, because he's, I believe he's a grad transfer.
Yep. Well, good luck to all of them.
Yeah. And, I think that's about anything else you wanted to discuss. Are you not watching because you said there wasn't going to be college football?
Oh, I wish. No, I just don't care.
Really? How do you not care?
No kidding. If Washington State was playing Idaho tomorrow, I would be in front of that TV in a heartbeat. Like, it's just, I do not. So the thing is, like, there are some people who are just fans of sport, and there are some people who are, like, fans of a team or a league. I care about the dynamics of the Pac-12. I don't care to watch Navy play BYU. Like, I just don't care. Even if it was a big game, even if it was a good game, I don't care. Like, I can name, like, four of their players, tops. I don't know what schemes they run. I could maybe name one of their coaches, I think. But other than that, I just don't care. And so it's just, everyone getting off on watching Central Arkansas. Was that Central Arkansas UAB a couple weeks ago or last week?
It might have been South Alabama, maybe? Central
Whatever
Arkansas.
Whatever.
No,
was. No. But, like,
I forget what it was.
How are you watching that? Come on. Like, or the weekend games. It was like South. That was where South Alabama was playing. The weekend games of just absolute dog crap. And it's just like, I don't love college football that much. I love watching the Pac-12. I like watching UCLA. I like watching the teams I know and the people I know. I don't want to watch some crap-ass league, you know, a bunch of players suck. That's not fun.
All right. Well, I just like watching football, so. But, I mean, I like the NFL. I like, you know, I play some fantasy. But I like to watch football, so I'm a big fan of that. So I'll try to watch. I won't watch the Thursday game because I'm going to watch NFL, but I'll try to catch some this weekend. And we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, I guess.
I guess we could take a break and then come back and do questions.
That sounds like a splendid idea, one I wholeheartedly co-sign. Should I make the noise?
Yeah, you make the noise.
All right. Well, Ryan, we've arrived at the middle of our show.
We are here.
Exciting for everybody out there in listener land. And we've got some exciting stuff to talk to you about. Not you, Ryan, but you, the listener. Because winning season returns at MyBookie. Winning season means doubling your first deposit. Winning season means Survivor, Super Contests, and Squares. At MyBookie, it's time to celebrate the NFL season with some extra cash in your pocket.
Yeah, Dave, sign up now and get your first deposit matched, dollar for dollar, all the way up to $1,000. And while you're at it, grab yourself an entry into the famed MyBookie Super Contest. What is the Super Contest? How do you play? It's simple. All you do is pick five NFL games against the spread each week, and you'll have a chance to win $100,000 guaranteed in cash prizes.
That's not even the best part. The best part is MyBookie has thousands of bets to choose from over the full NFL slate and NBA playoffs. From live betting to championship futures, every play you want to make is waiting at MyBookie. Make your picks, win big, collect your cash. It's very simple. Use promo code PAC12 and double your first deposit now. It's a no-brainer. Your winning season begins today only at MyBookie.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
We are back here on the Podcast of Champions. Dave, do you have a good break?
I had the best break of my life. I drank some hot tea after doing the sound effect, because that was a lot on the vocal cords, you know? I serenaded you, actually, in fact, with This Magic Moment, a beautiful song by Jay and the Americans from 1968.
Ooh.
And, yeah, that's just where we are right now.
And good job with the break music. You just created that since we don't have it here. And now we got to test the vocal cords again, because we got to read some long questions.
I don't know if I can handle this today, but I'm going to give it my best shot. And I'm certainly, under no circumstances, am I going to make any jokes about what reading these questions might make me do.
Nice. I think we got Hithloday first. Do you want to start?
I'd love to start with our friend Hithloday Almond.
Okay.
Demonstrate value. Is that a command? Is he asking us to?
There was no punctuation, so I'm going to assume. What do you think?
Telling us to demonstrate value. All right.
Yeah.
I enjoyed hearing the enthusiastic and versatile discussion, plus Ryan and David, on which universe to live in as you accidentally recreated Rawls' Veil of Ignorance. How appropriate to this podcast.
So that's like you're supposed to picture yourself.
Basically,
another society.
Yeah,
like,
if you're picturing another society.
Without any status.
Exactly. You're picturing another society, but you are not given any information on where you would fall into the hierarchy in that society. And so, the theory is that in that situation, you will be making a decision that is moral and just, because it's all about self-interest. You know, if you knew you were going to be on top, then you would make the decisions that favor the people on top. But if you don't know where you're going to fall in the broad scheme of things, then you'll make a decision that's more broadly equitable for everyone. You're going to design.
I don't think that's what we did last week, because
we were focusing on death, but there was some speculation about you wouldn't be a Jedi. You'd be just some technician working on an X-Wing.
Oh, I was thinking like, well, I don't know. I guess I was trying to picture myself as something cool. I wasn't going to say like, well, I wasn't picking like Harry Potter over Star Wars because I was worried that if I was a muggle that, would be worse off in the Harry Potter world than if I was a technician on a Death Star in the Star Wars world.
I get it.
But I don't know. So in my mind, I wasn't doing Rawls' Veil of Ignorance, but maybe you were.
Maybe you were ignorant of the Veil of Ignorance.
Yes. I think so. Well, sorry. Okay. So who was having the discussion then, if it wasn't us?
Bree was on the show. But I think he was making a polite allusion to her being better than us.
Which is fine.
I respect it. I think that was
It's hard for her to have a discussion by herself, though. We had to be included somehow.
Well, I've certainly discussed all angles of a single point in one of my diatribes on this show before.
Very true. Okay.
All right. Here we go. This Monday is the 24th anniversary of Bob Toledo's opener at UCLA, the first game of the post-Terry Donahue era. The program is 160 and 138, 53.7% winning percentage in that time under five different head coaches. As a warm-up, please rank them, not in terms of how many bad outcomes happened on their watch, but by how much lasting damage they did to the brand. Bob Toledo, Carl Durrell, Rick Neuheisel, Jim Mora, Chip Kelly. Okay, so damage to the brand. You got to go Carl Durrell, probably number one. Bob Toledo had UCLA on the brink of a national championship appearance before the Miami debacle, so you can't have him too high. And honestly, the brand hadn't diminished that far when he was fired. It was just, you know, kind of a couple mediocre years after nearly reaching the pinnacle. Durrell brought it really low opposite Pete Carroll. And I don't think Durrell was objectively the worst coach in this bunch. I think Rick Neuheisel or Zombie Chip Kelly definitely fall below Durrell. But I think in terms of where he came in the scheme of things and how it impacted UCLA's trajectory, I think Durrell is number one here. You couldn't just roll over and surrender to that USC team, which is essentially what Durrell did. For five straight years, you know, both on the recruiting trail and otherwise. And it more or less permanently, I thought, put UCLA in second tier status in the LA area. Obviously, there was the uptick under Mora, but for the most part, it's been a USC, you know, 20 years in that, you know, UCLA versus USC. And Durrell was a big part of that, just kind of rolling over and dying against Carroll. Then I would go lasting damage. The thing is, it's hard to project right now, but I'd probably go Chip Kelly as number two.
Wow.
I don't know, given the pandemic, given everything, like, we were already thinking it was going to be a long recovery period after Chip Kelly whenever he leaves, just because of the way he's decimated recruiting, the way he's kind of just turned UCLA into this weird program that doesn't recruit at a high level anymore. But on top of that, now you're adding in the budget issues, the pandemic that are kind of not controlled by him, but the actual real damage he's doing to the program combined with those issues may lead to UCLA being a second tier program for decades. Obviously we all hope not, but that could very well be the case. Then after that, it's pick your poison. Rick Neuheisel wasn't good. He was very bad. He's probably the worst of the bunch in terms of what he actually did, given the talent he had at his disposal. But he did load up the program with talent for Jim Mora to then do a lot with. Mora is probably number five on this list. I don't think he did lasting damage to the program. I think he caused a resurgence. Even if you take the 6 years on balance, I still think it was a net positive, especially given what surrounded his era at UCLA. And then Toledo's probably fourth, and Neuheisel's probably third.
Yeah.
But yeah, in order of damage, it's Durrell, Kelly, Neuheisel, Toledo, Mora.
That list makes sense to me. And Neuheisel, from his point on, the team had a full complement of gloves, so that he did change the game that way,
and he brought that to everyone's attention. You know, that was the most important thing. And he's continued to bring that to people's attention. Like, before Neuheisel... Well, that's the thing, is before Neuheisel, who would have known how important gloves were and a proper allotment of gloves were to the overall play and performance of a football program? You wouldn't have known. So whatever you might think of him as a coach, I think his contributions to the discourse, his contributions to the understanding of college football just cannot be denied.
Yeah. I mean, it's about awareness. We're in an era we need to be more aware of things. And Rick Neuheisel was a trailblazer for that. So
truly
that's great.
Truly was. All right. And then the final paragraph. I often think of UCLA as the Washington of the South. Big city, putative academic prestige, claims of past glory, a quarter century of irrelevance, the Dennis Reynolds of their gang. It took the Huskies 8 years and two coaches to go from 0-12 to conference champs. Do you boys think the Bruins could recover any faster than that? The recruiting landscape has changed since 10 or 20 years ago when Carl Durrell could have a top 20 class for the asking, now that Herm, Mario, Dabo, and the entire SEC have taken up residence in Southern California. It certainly could happen faster than that. Would I bet on it? No. The way it happens is the way it always happens, is you hire a good enough coach. And if you hire a good enough coach, they'll recruit well enough to do that. And if you don't, you won't. And that might feel a little circular, but I think it's true. I think the UCLA program is going to be mediocre-ish until they once again hire a good coach. And a good coach can go, I mean, you're talking as low as first 3 years Jim Mora. You know, somebody with some energy, not necessarily an X's and O's aficionado, but somebody who comes in with a plan and some energy and just rights the ship. I mean, UCLA, even if you do acknowledge some change in the recruiting landscape, right, that Oregon is more of a national recruiting power than it was a decade ago. And you acknowledge that Washington has certainly picked up its recruitment since, you know, even the Mora years. And you acknowledge that USC is at some point going to get this thing right again. And you acknowledge that the SEC is still, you know, going to try to recruit California. A UCLA program that is actually recruiting at a high level should be able to fend off even those programs. And that's actually, you know, got some hope. Right now, the UCLA program is hopeless. And I think that comes across in recruiting. Like, I think it's hard to pitch a program that's been so bad through two seasons under Chip Kelly and through the last two seasons of the Mora era, and going into the third season under a coach who's clearly failing. I think it's hard to pitch. And I think that being hard to pitch, I think Clay Helton being hard to pitch at USC has led to a lot of the successes that other programs have had recruiting California. But I think if both programs or one of those programs was operating once again at a high-ish level, it's not as if Clemson will suddenly stop recruiting California or stop pulling occasionally really good players, but there's a lot of kids who are going to want to stay home, and there always will be. And if the programs are good enough, a lot of those really good players are going to stay home. And that kind of thing cascades pretty quick, because if enough of those guys stay in one cycle, then your team's a little bit better the next year. And then more guys stay home the next cycle, and your team's a little bit better again. It just requires, I mean, we're at a point where USC and UCLA are probably, over the last, 3 years, they've been about as bad as they've been combined. Like, when was the last time they've both been just kind of hopeless programs?
Well, the USC did win the Pac-12 once during that time, but...
Whatever. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
When have they been, like, in a position where neither one would ever be talked about for, like, I guess USC has been, because people don't know what they're talking about, but for, like, winning a national championship or even being in the conversation?
Yeah. No, I think it's been a while. This is a rough stretch for both. So, I agree.
So... Anyway, I think it could happen quicker, but I wouldn't bet on it. I think 8 years was pretty fast to go from 0-12 to conference champs. And like I said, the pandemic, there's a lot of weird ramifications of everything that's happened in the last year that make it really hard to predict how anything's going to look even in a couple of years, let alone 10 years now.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for that one, Hifladay. This one is from Thomas.
Oh, boy.
It is not short. Pac-12 headquarters hysteria. Hey guys, and Bree. Unfortunately, Bree's not here, but I will pass it along. I'm writing in today very reluctantly about a topic for which there has been lots of heat lately, but almost no light. Yes, I'm referring to the cost of the Pac-12 headquarters in San Francisco.
Ooh,
so this could be good. I'm keenly aware that some in the audience at this point will stop listening. Not
some in the audience, Tom. Like, you're talking to somebody who stopped listening.
I'm reading the question. I stopped listening. I'm interested in fully understanding the issue. But for those people who are looking for something more than hysteria, this email is for you.
Oh, God.
As probably all 78... man, he even takes a shot at us. 78 of your regular listeners know, ESPN's Kyle
Bodicor...
That's not
a shot. He's overestimating by, like, 40.
Fair point. ESPN's Kyle Bonagora posted a tweet including the Pac-12's 18/19 tax year filing for the rent of its headquarters, which, as reported, includes the location of the studios of the Pac-12 network. In the same tweet, Bonagora listed the other Power 5 conferences' respective rent on their headquarters. The gap between them appears astounding, because it is, with the Conference of Champions inexplicably paying millions while its peers somehow needing only a fraction of that. The assertion, not just Bonagora, but other colleagues like John Canzano gave, is predictable. Real estate in San Francisco is so atrociously expensive that moving the conference's base anywhere else would fix the problem. It's a great story, But alas, not exactly true. The reality is that money isn't the basis for every decision an organization makes. Consider the following. You've got 2 points here. One, the other Power Five conferences don't actually own studios. That's probably smart, but okay. First, ESPN actually operates both the SEC and ACC networks from their existing facilities in Charlotte and Bristol. Moreover, those two conferences only have a revenue sharing agreement, so the indirect cost of the studio is rolled into other expenses that may not even be transferable to the SEC or ACC. The Big Ten, meanwhile, does have a partial ownership of Big Ten Network. Big Ten has a partial ownership of the Big Ten Network. Its studios are not where the conference is, however. Big Ten Network actually broadcasts not from the league's office park near O'Hare Airport, but the pricey Montgomery Ward building in downtown Chicago. And the Big 12, of course, doesn't have a network at all. In other words, it's hard to pay rent on things that don't exist or you don't own. Okay, two, there are significant benefits of having the Pac-12 network at its present location, but they are intangible. For example, the conference gets to share a building with Comcast Regional Sports Networks. This might not sound important, but it means that building is already wired and designed to operate not just as a studio, but the broadcast command center for the Pac-12 that needs to control multiple feeds. Then there's the fact that Comcast is the single largest cable provider that carries the channel and thus the largest source of revenue. And even if Comcast left, the building is still in the heart of San Francisco's tech industry and to BART, which offers a quick ride not only to the city's international airport, but also to also the UC office of the president. And while people think I'm defending Larry Scott, I'm not. It's the other people that work hard every day in the conference offices that don't deserve being second-guessed when, clearly, Canzano and Bonagora are thinking with their respective hearts, not heads. In sum, this is why the conference, other conferences make fun of us. We spend all this time and energy criticizing business decisions instead of worrying about coaching and recruiting. Don't get me wrong. I like playing armchair CEO as much as the next guy, but these types of attacks are really unfair. Eagerly awaiting the next Zoom call, Thomas.
Thank you, Thomas. I will not do, because you spent a lot of time on this, I will not do what I would otherwise do, which is make a loud fart noise right now. I'm not going to do it. The other power conferences don't actually own studios. They all make significantly more money than the Pac-12. The Pac-12 shouldn't own its own studio. That's where we are. They do own their own studio. Okay. Do they have to have it? This is your second point. Do they have to have it in the most expensive, you know, real estate market in the United States? Nothing you said in this paragraph is compelling. It gets to share a building with Comcast Regional Sports Networks. Who cares?
So are you saying, like, if it wasn't pre-wired first, like, it would have cost even more?
Like real estate in Sacramento is not as expensive as it is in the Bay Area, in the actual Bay Area. Real estate in Salt Lake City is not even as expensive as that. You could find a big city that is wired for internet that probably has a regional sports network from some cable company, if you're really into that, that's not as expensive as San Francisco. In a time when they are just cutting salaries because they have to save a little bit of money, it is worth noting that they're paying a shitload of money in rent. That they probably, and this is not something that we're just bringing up now. This is something that we've known for years now. And we've been talking about it for years now. It was a, it's not like, these aren't like things where you have to talk about one or the other. The Pac-12, a lot of the schools make bad hiring decisions and they don't recruit very well and they're in, you know, financial trouble of their own accord. But we can also talk about the conference wasting a bunch of money and being run by a dilettante. Like, we can do that. So, yeah, this was a stupid decision, and it's also stupid that UCLA, you know, that Chip Kelly's not good at coaching football. These are both stupid things. We can keep these two thoughts in our heads at one time.
Yeah. No, I agree with you, and it's like comparing apples and oranges, but you're going to like all the other conferences were going to an apple pie making contest, and they have the apples, and you're bringing an orange to making apple pies. Like you didn't need to have an orange. Like you didn't need to have your own studio. That was a bad decision.
You're bringing an orange, and then you're also bringing like a $40 million orange press to turn it into the pie or something.
Right. And your pie did not turn out nearly as well as the other people
like,
that just had
like,
apples.
That's just like, obviously the pie is a piece of crap, but how did you spend this much money making it?
Yes, you spent more money on your orange.
Why did you drive to this community baking contest in a Lamborghini? Why?
Yes, I love food analogies. That works. I think it works all around.
It's perfect.
All right. I think you got a long one here from Bernie.
All right. Oh, got to get the gear up for this one. All right. Oh, got to clear those cords. Okay. Can we take a break for hot tea? Or?
Yeah. Okay. Right. I actually kind of need one, but you know.
All right. NCAA championship. Hi, guys. First time I've written you in 2020. My question is, who will win an NCAA championship first? USC football or UCLA basketball? Thanks. Hope you're both safe and well. Trick question, Bernie. UCLA basketball, because there is no NCAA championship in football. Boom! Roasted.
Very good.
Yeah, I don't know. Real answer? I think I'd probably go UCLA basketball still.
That's a good question. I think UCLA basketball is closer.
They're closer right now, which is my main reason.
Yeah, but what do you think it's harder to do? Because, like, say UCLA, Mick Cronin gets like the top recruiting class like 2 years in a row or whatever, and they are like the best team in the NCAA, like they're the best team in the country, and USC loads up, like they hire Urban Meyer, they hire somebody, and they're like two great recruiting classes in a row, and it's like Pete Carroll's third year, like they're the team to beat. Who would you give the better chance of winning a championship? Oh, is it easier for the best team
definitely
in football
USC.
To win?
Definitely USC. It's way easier for a football team to do it because they don't have to get through the NCAA tournament.
Right.
Getting through the NCAA tournament, even if you're really, really good, so you've got like a 99% chance of winning your first game, then you've got maybe a, 80% chance of winning your second game, and then it gets into like a lot of 60% chances. You're like rolling the dice a lot, whereas a USC that's really, really good, you're probably... better than 80% to win most of your regular season games. I don't know. I could go either way because there are some challenges now with the way the Pac-12 is perceived, with the addition of the playoff, with just the overall strength of the rest of the conference in terms of them using analytics more for the college football playoff calculation. You really can't afford more than one loss ever.
You're right.
So, it's iffy. Previous years, it was definitely football. But I think now with the addition of the playoff and with more analytics being involved, I think it might be a bit more of a toss-up.
I think I'm going to lean to UCLA basketball, too, for maybe the same reason. The scenario I gave you, I agree. I think it's easier for the best team in football to win than the best team in basketball. But I don't think either USC or UCLA are going to become the best in their respective sports. And if you're not the best, I think you're on the basketball side, you have a better chance of winning. So, like, if USC is, like, really, really good, but, like, Alabama's amazing, Alabama's probably still going to win, right?
Well, that's it. And UCLA,
like,
as
UCLA
long as they're a top 15,
really, really good team.
You're a top 15 team that gets hot at the right time, you could win the NCAA tournament.
Right, you could beat a Duke that has Zion Williamson or whatever. Like,
well, look at it this way: when Sam Darnold had USC rolling at the end of that year, they might have been the best team in the country. We don't know because they weren't given an opportunity to play for it.
Yeah,
a UCLA team that surges at the end of the year in basketball will have a chance to play for it. Maybe as a 3 seed, maybe as a 4 seed, but they'll have a chance to play for it and win it.
Yeah, good stuff. Interesting. Yeah, I think we're both. I think UCLA basketball right now. I would, if I had to bet. That's where I would bet.
Yeah.
Thanks, Bernie. This one is from Mike in Full Shear, Texas. The red blue divide. Do you think this will be political? We'll see. Ryan and David. As I was driving home today from the airport, I listened to your September 2nd POC episode. You can imagine my distress when I heard the anguish in David's voice as he described a red/blue divide when it comes to playing college football this year. David spoke forlornly of a red-blue political divide, deciding which conferences would play and which wouldn't. I want David to know that while the politicians are divided, the people of our great nation are not. David, don't let cable news convince you that your fellow Americans are anything but united in this time of COVID-19. Every week, I travel this great nation, spending time in red and blue states equally, and nowhere I go, Americans have their masks. No matter where I go, Americans have their masks dangling from one ear, covering their chin or below their nose to ensure they could smell the virus in time to warn their fellow countrymen. That's a smart way to do it. Yeah, because you can smell that virus. It's like the
it's got a real scent to it. It's got a body, full bodied.
I think they added the scent, like the natural gas, they put that like rotten egg smell to it. They've added some scent to the COVID-19. I do have to admit, though, David, you are correct in your belief that a red-blue divide in at least one area, while SMU and Texas State did have fans in the stands, while the California stadiums were empty, for what I could tell, all the Californians were in Las Vegas casinos at the time. I hope this raises your spirits, David. Mike from Fulshear, Texas. P.S. BBJ, you are a great addition to the show. So talk about Bree.
Yes. Great stuff, Mike. Thank you. It did raise my spirits.
Vegas, a lot of the Vegas casinos going on here. That's
Dude, can you just scroll down in this next email that I've got to read?
Hold on, let me see. I will. Ooh, this is this is a scroll.
This is the longest email we've ever received. It actually is.
I don't get screwed.
Yeah. Let me scroll down and see who it's from. Hang on. This is from AJ in Arizona. Thank you, AJ. Okay. Washington offensive line follow-up is the subject line. Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is AJ in Arizona, never been on the P. First time, long time. I've never had much to add to your always stellar analysis. However, 2 weeks ago, your breakdown of a potential great matchup caused me to think more than ever before. This is lengthy. Feel free to save for another time if you're getting to the end of the show. I've broken this down into what I believe are comparable categories regarding Casey from Tacoma's email about the Washington O-line. Hobbits.
Wait, so he's compared to the Washington offensive line and the Hobbits and Ewoks conversation all mixed into one.
Well, I'm pretty sure that was the initial email was it was a Washington O-line joke and it was Hobbits versus Ewoks. So anyway, Hobbits. Recruits. Bilbo Baggins. Went on an adventure, saved dwarves from spiders. So these are written like evaluations. Saved dwarves from spiders, wood elves, a dragon, and their own hubris. Won a game of riddles in the dark, 5 stars. Frodo Baggins, ring bearer, shows incredible resilience to the One Ring, not much of a fighter, 3 stars. Samwise, quote, Sam Gamgee, okay with a sword, great with a frying pan, loyal to Frodo, cleared out the Tower of Cirith. Cirith Ungol, by putting fear into an orc horde, saw through Smeagol's BS, was able to resist the ring and return it to Frodo. 5 stars. Okay, sorry. I can already see your bias here. All right, AJ. You've given 2 5-stars to Bilbo and Sam. So Bilbo, who goes nuts and is like a demented old man by the time Lord of the Rings comes out, and then Sam, who's like an equal partner in the most boring chapters from The Two Towers and Return of the King. No. I'm sorry. No. Frodo and Sam are a combined 6 stars. They're each 3 stars, solid 3 stars, maybe with some upside. Maybe they're in that high 3-star territory where 247 has them ranked 4 stars, but the aggregate has it in 3 stars. Maybe. All right. Anyway, Pippin took. Kills Uruk-hai and orcs with rocks, enlists into the army of Gondor, kills a troll, size advantage as one of the 2 tallest hobbits in history thanks to Treebeard's Entrot, PED issue, 4 stars. Wow. Meriadoc Mary Brandybuck, kills Uruk-hai and orcs with rocks, enlists into the army of Rohan, assists in killing the Witch King of Angmar, the other of the 2 tallest hobbits in history, 5 stars.
I don't remember, Mary. Which one was that one?
Well, Mary's the one who stabs the leader of the Nazgul.
Okay.
He's the one who kills him at the battle in front of Gondor.
Okay. Yeah, I don't remember all these names.
White City,
and
I should
stuff.
Say.
Are people still listening right now?
Oh, God, I hope not. We've still got a long way to go on this question, everyone. All right, offense. This is an evaluation of the Hobbit's offense. Very reactionary, willing to step up when a mountain troll and goblins have already wreaked havoc in the minds of Moria. or after Uruk-hai have already overrun their fellowship, or after Saruman and ruffians have already taken over the Shire. Once they get going, though, they can be formidable. Defense mostly consists of hiding and running, able to elude ringwraiths and the Eye of Sauron. As a group, many hobbits are able to set up a barricade of wagons and take out ruffians in the Battle of Bywater. Book. Equipment. Sting, swords, knives, rocks, frying pans, bows and arrows, and gardening equipment. They wear elven cloaks that help them hide, and armor including one set of impenetrable mithril. Strengths. Loyal, work as a group, able to rise to the occasion, and coachable. Weaknesses. Generally like to be lazy and passive. Favorite hobbies include eating, drinking ale, smoking pipeweed, and being pleasant, even toward an unexpected party of unwelcome guests. Worst loss, either fighting the more talented ringwraiths at Weathertop, resulting in the near death of Frodo, or getting overrun by a band of Uruk-hai, resulting in the breaking of the fellowship. Best win, the big four rallied the residents of the Shire to fight against the wizard Saruman and the ruffians, showing that each hobbit had the potential for greatness, once again from the book. Overall, there is a lot more in hobbits than one would guess, and a deal more than they have any idea about themselves. Elves, dwarves, Ents, the Mithrandir, and the King of the West hold hobbits in high regard.
There now, is a lot of details in that.
Like, Jesus Christ.
Like he went through the book, like, literally to find... I mean, you don't remember all these tribes' names and things like that? Like,
I remember basically everyone in there except for Cirith Ungol. I don't remember that.
Okay.
But no, I mean, I'm not a huge nerd. Like, I do know most of this stuff. I just wouldn't, like, I wouldn't probably have done this, but I'm respecting it greatly.
To be fair, I kind of think you would have done this.
Maybe.
Like, I could picture you listening to...
No. The next part is actually where it gets friggin' crazy to me.
Okay. All
okay. Right, because the hobbits, that's all in a book. It's in text. You know what their names are. Who can name an Ewok from the friggin' movie?
Yeah, how do you do that?
AJ in Arizona can do it. Here we go.
The credit.
Ewoks. Recruits. Paplu. This is a thing's name. Stole a speeder bike as a distraction for the rebellion. 4 stars.
Wait, is that the one that met Princess Leia first?
It must have been. It must have been.
I think that was the same one, right? So, yep. I mean, he's also, you would say, like, you know, a great negotiator. He was, a scout.
I think 4 stars is an underrating.
Yes.
Lumat Chukatrok. As the woodcutter for the village, he's strong. He's also wise as a teacher to Mace in Caravan of Courage. He sacrificed himself to save Sindel's family and the Ewoks. 4 stars.
Wait.
Like, that was not English. Like, that entire description of whatever this was is not English. I do not understand it.
That has to be from a book or something.
It,
That's not.
It obviously is from a book. I cannot handle it, though. All right, okay. Next one. Tebow. Knows a little magic and hopes to be the Ewok shaman. 2 stars. Nippet, the cute baby in Jedi. 5 stars. Wicket, hit himself in the face with a sling, however showed potential in helping save Sindel in battle for Endor. Rudy-esque walk-on. Wicket, I think I knew that name. I don't think I knew any of the other ones. Yeah.
I didn't know any of them had a name.
Wicket, I want to say, was in the Return of the Jedi video game that I played on Super Nintendo 20 years ago.
Wow. All right.
Okay. Offense. They are able to effectively attack as a group when they have time to plan. There were numerous booby traps set up in the forest to take out large AT-ST walkers and platoons of troopers. Defense. With planning, a defensive ambush was set up in Endor that momentarily repelled Turok and the Marauders, low-budget orcs. However, the Ewoks were ultimately saved by the blasters on Noah's ship, Wilford Brimley, R.I.P. Equipment, spears, bows and arrows, slings, forest booby traps, lassos, magic that doesn't do much, no relevant armor. Strengths, they are intelligent, scrappy, and savage, beating troopers with sticks, crushing AT-STs with logs, and tripping the giant Gorax down a cavern in caravan. Also, they attempted to cook Han, Luke, and Chewie alive with plans to feed them to Leia. Weaknesses, they are afraid of some forms of magic, as evidenced by Luke using the Force to help C-3PO fly in Jedi. They also struggled against the sorceress Chiral in Endor. Additionally, generally clumsy. Worst loss? In a surprise attack, the Ewok village was decimated by Turok and the Marauders, accompanied by Chiral. Spoiler alert, Sindel and Wicket's families are straight up murdered in the first 5 minutes of Battle for Endor. By the way, Sindel is a human girl that's 5 or 6. Best win? The Ewoks helped defeat the Empire in a land battle using sticks and stones of various sizes. However, despite Kenobi's assertion that Imperial Stormtroopers have precise aim in New Hope, Stormtroopers have shown that they have the inability to hit anyone or anything of importance. The one Stormtrooper MVP hit Leia in the arm and once before Han shot in the arm once before Han shot the trooper in the face. Overall, the Ewoks show that they're at their best when they have time to plan and their enemy is technologically advanced and wears helmets that hinder sight.
Holy cow. Okay. I feel like I've never seen this movie. And I haven't.
I have no idea what anything is referring to that is not from the actual movie.
Right.
No. No idea.
And then what is the AT-ST? I thought it was AT-ATs. Are those,
no, no, the AT-ATs are the ones with four legs. The AT-STs are the ones with two legs.
Okay. All right. But we would call them AT-ATs. Was that not right? Or is that like...
I don't know, man.
AT-ATs. Okay.
I don't know, man. I think it's AT-ATs. I think Imperial Walkers. We're not done. There's still more text in this email than there was in Hitler days. Like, left to go. Honestly, if Ewoks and Hobbits ever met, they would have a pretty sweet party, but that's not why we're here. The three scenarios. So these were offered in the original email.
Right.
In a bar fight, the Ewoks would likely be more aggressive. The first thing we see one do is poke Leia with a spear. Hobbits have higher alcohol tolerance and would be taken by surprise by aggressive drunk... would be taken by surprise by aggressive drunk teddy bears. Hobbits would also be too polite to stop anything. Ewoks slap hard. They slap... I don't know why I'm giggling so much now, but it's... I can't... Ewoks slap hard. They slapped the shit out of the AT-ST drivers.
Presumably to death.
Presumably to death. Advantage Ewoks. Something about the idea of drunken teddy bears slapping the shit out of somebody, presumably. I'm losing it. I'm losing it now. In a tag team wrestling match, the Ewoks slap hard, but have also shown themselves to be what George Lucas always intended them to be, bumbling cuties to sell toys to kids. Hobbits are essentially World War II Brits. A Merry and Pippin tag team, especially after the War of the Ring, would be intimidating. Despite the slap power, and based on the brief scene of a stormtrooper tossing an Ewok with ease in Jedi, the Hobbits would win. Merry and Pippin went whole hog jumping on and attacking the cave troll in Moria. Advantage Hobbits. In an all-out epic battle front, Ewoks would take an early lead with a surprise attack. However, Hobbits use similar tech, and large Ewok booby traps would be useless. Hobbits have skilled archers, and in close combat, repressed ferocity, combined with armor and swords, would be too much for Ewok hide and sticks. There was a Hobbit army in the final chapters of The Return of the King. Advantage Hobbits. Thank you for keeping up with the podcast, even in these stagnant Pac-12 times, AJ in Arizona.
Oh, God, AJ. There's a lot in there.
I'm just going to say it. Disagree.
Yeah. Still going with the Ewoks.
Oh, God.
I think he's made...
Yeah, it's a long text message next. Oh, fuck.
Oh, this one's me. Okay. Oh, there's also a link. So this one's a link to a New York Times article. Oh, my God. This is really long. This is from the analyst. Given that David has expressed skepticism about college football being played this season, I believe he will be better educated about COVID testing and the complexities of the test after reading this New York Times article that was published roughly 10 days ago. The bottom line is, according to the New York Times, the actual number of people in the USA who are infected with COVID might be closer to 600,000 and not 6 million.
No, that's not what it says. No, I read the article. That's not what it says. Don't say this.
So, okay, hold on. Well, I'll read the rest of this paragraph. Then, do you want to paraphrase?
Yeah, go for it.
We can paraphrase. The New York Times does not do a great job in giving us all the info, so let me fill in some details. First, the PCR test heats up and cools down the double helix DNA virus fragments after converting the virus's RNA to DNA many times to determine if someone is infected, and these are called cycles. Second, there are no global standards regarding how many cycles are required to determine if someone is infected. Third, the goal of performing these cycles is to create hundreds of millions, if not billions, of double helix strands of fragments of the virus's DNA. For example, China recommends 30 cycles. So their PCR tests produced roughly 1 billion, 2 to the 30th power, of the double helix DNA strands. This is going down a rabbit hole. Germany recommends 33 cycles, so their PCR tests produce approximately 8 billion DNA strands. Why is this difference important? Because epidemiologists say someone is infected with COVID if the PCR produces about 500 million or more COVID fragments. So you can see if the cycle count produces 8 billion strands, 33 cycles, the likelihood of generating 500 million COVID DNA fragments is much higher than if one generates 1 billion DNA strands, 30 cycles, from the same person. So how does the New York Times arrive at upwards of 90% false positives in the USA? Well, our labs are employing 40 cycles, which produce roughly 1 trillion DNA strands, 2 to the 40th power. Clearly, it is substantially easier to produce 500 million COVID fragments when one generates over 1 trillion DNA strands. It's like coin flipping. If I have 1,000 people and I ask them to flip a coin 100 times, and anyone who produces 70 or more heads gets $100. Out of those 1,000 people, statistics will tell you roughly 100 people would win $100. But if I ask the same 1,000 people to flip the coin 150 times, we would expect heads coming up 70 or more for nearly 600 people, or about 6 times more than those who flipped the coin 100 times. In other words, we got more, quote, winners in the latter group merely because we had them flip it more. And America is getting more COVID infections merely because, on average, our labs are producing 1,000 times more double helix DNA strands than the rest of the world. This largely explains why there are so many Americans who are, quote, infected but are asymptomatic. It also partly explains why, according to the CDC, there have been only 11,000 Americans who have died from COVID who did not have any other comorbidity. The New York Times is not saying COVID is a hoax. What they are saying is that if the USA employed the same number of PCR cycles count as the rest of the world in doing, and what test experts recommend, there would be about 600,000 Americans who are infected with COVID and not the massive number of over 6 million that is quoted every day and scaring every one of us. My view is that COVID can be very lethal, but just for a fraction of the general public. And those are mostly 80-year-olds with at least 2 underlying medical issues like diabetes, hypertension, obesity, etc. Shoo, regards the analyst. And then he includes a link to the New York Times article.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the underlying point is true that the more cycles you do of this stuff, that you're going to end up with more sensitive tests that catch people who may or may not be transmitting it. I think it's not a meaningless distinction, but relatively, because first, it's not 600,000. It would be some order of magnitude more than that, who would still be positive, because you're basing it off of, I think, going down to 30 cycles, which I don't think they would be doing. They'd be going down to like 33 or 35. So it would be, I don't know, a few million still. But even going back to that, more people have died in the United States than have died anywhere. So I care what the denominator is, like out of how many cases, but I also, like, whatever the case may be, our outbreak is worse than every other country because more people have died. Right?
Yeah.
Like, isn't that an easy way to think about it?
Well, he's saying, like, if someone died, like they had a heart attack or something and they were tested for COVID, but
they
were positive here, but they wouldn't have been positive if they were in China, I think is what he's saying. So there wouldn't have been a COVID death in another country, but they were here. I don't understand this stuff.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think he's making a logical leap that isn't necessarily in evidence. Because the thing is, like, all that stuff about conspiracy theories, about death certificates and stuff, it's not really borne out by any, like, significant analysis. Like, if they're listed as having died of COVID, it's because that was a significant contributing factor to their death. And all the stuff about, oh, all these people have comorbidities. Well, I've got news for you. And this is a fun one. You ready for it? Everyone who dies of something would have eventually died of something else.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy how that works.
That is true.
But the thing we do with modern health and, like, medicine and stuff, I know this is another wild thing. We try to prolong life. And so what we can do to prevent people who might otherwise die, even relatively soon, like in the next few years of something, is to prevent them from dying of the other things as well. So, okay. I just, you know, that might be a useful way to think about it when everyone keeps talking about, well, I mean, there's a few useful ways to think about it. Everyone keeps talking about all these people with comorbidities. Well, guess what? When you look at the list of the comorbidities that are associated with a higher risk of COVID death, it accounts for about 50% of the population. And then on top of that, we still don't want those people to die of this, right?
Right.
Like, we're all in agreement there. Like, having, like, slightly elevated blood pressure shouldn't be a death sentence for you, right? So maybe we just figure this thing out instead of just signing these people off for death.
I get it. I try not to, like, I don't know. It's just 6 months of the stuff. You start to, like,
I'm done. I'm totally done. And I don't want to read a friggin' email about this, like, trying to explain it to me like I'm an idiot.
But the question
I am an idiot, but not, you don't need to explain this to me.
I think I've been naive where I think about it as you have it or you don't, right? Like, there's a thing, like, it's a binary situation. It's a one or a zero, but it's obviously not that. Like, you could have, like, a little flu. Like, you can't be a little pregnant. You're pregnant or you're not. But in this case, it's like, you could have a little flu. You could have, I guess you could have, like, a little COVID, and we're just, our threshold is lower. So we can, you have a little COVID here, you have COVID, and maybe in China, you had a little COVID, you didn't have COVID. I don't know what that means. I mean, the reporting number is like, who cares? But people use those for, like, political reasons and all that kind of stuff. I didn't really realize that there. I thought you were, like, you sick with it or you weren't sick with it, you know? And in this case, it sounds like, well, it just, there's a threshold that this is brand new. It's a novel virus, right?
Well, so
what is sick with it? Like, what is the right number to use? Like, the number of cycles?
The importance of it is for, I mean, and it's detailed in the piece. The importance of it is for essentially contact tracing. It's not whether or not you were infected with it. You have some of it, so you are infected with it. It's whether you're infected with it in a meaningful enough way to account for needing to contact trace you. Like, if you have it and it only shows up for 40 cycles, it only shows up in the whatever, when you do 40 cycles versus 35, you're probably not transmitting that virus. Or you maybe were in the past, but you're not anymore, or whatever the case may be. So it's not something that you would need to worry about significantly from, like, a public health standpoint. Or at least it's not worth a ton of, you know, extra resources. But I think that was what I was reading in that piece. That was the main argument being made. Not necessarily that people are going to use it for determining whether or not this is a serious outbreak, because that's all everyone is going to do is try to, you know, continue to win an internet argument.
Right. That's all it is. Yeah.
Yeah. But
I guess the point is, like, well, is there at the lower threshold, or I guess it would be higher threshold, like in China, would someone be negative that could still walk around and have enough to get someone else sick? Or if that's worse than someone in America who's said to be positive but doesn't really have enough virus to get anyone else sick. Like, I guess that would be better. Like, you're being more cautious here, but being more cautious might make the numbers look worse, I guess, if that's fair.
I mean, it'll make the case numbers look worse. I just don't know how it's – I'd be interested to see any analysis that's saying it's making deaths look worse.
Yeah. No, that's – yeah, that makes sense.
Because the sensitivity at which they'd be catching it, I just don't know.
All right. Well, we got some – another long one. We've each had two long ones. You had the longest, though. You did have
that. That was egregious.
Although I had you know, epidemiology class in one of mine, so I don't know about that.
That was brutal. That took the energy right out of me. This is from Brad in Portland. Marvel superheroes in the Pac-12. Hey guys, after this weekend, I really wish I could be asking a football-related question, but in the Pac-12, we are still in the off-season. The other week, someone had a question to compare teams to superheroes. One of the problems they had was that they only gave you superheroes with really strong good powers. Below is hopefully a more well-rounded list. I only used Marvel superheroes. All right, for Washington, he has Spider-Man. Locally, he is a big deal and a major player in saving people. While he is well-known out of the area he protects, he rarely is a player on the global level. Okay, that checks out for me. Washington State, Wolverine. As far as superpowers go, Wolverine is pretty weak. He is just a little guy that can't be killed. Kind of like the Cougars, despite being in Pullman and appearing on the edge of program death, they make a comeback. Also at ESPN Game Day, I'm sure you can find a Wolverine and Wazoo fan. Okay, fine. USC, Captain Marvel. She has been made to be one of the most powerful Avengers, if not the most, and yet the only thing that can keep her down is herself. That pretty much sums up USC.
I don't know anything about Captain. I never saw the movie. I don't know anything about Captain Marvel. So
she might be a little too powerful for present state USC, but fine.
So, but she's like badass. Like she's powerful.
Yeah. She's the strongest Avenger.
Okay.
UCLA, Thor. Dave, you hit the nail on this one last time. Currently, they are Fat Thor, but with a little work and a new head coach, they could be so much more. Arizona State, Black Panther, a solid superhero and leader of the area. Arizona State definitely rules Arizona and always a contender in the South. Arizona is Luke Cage. Now, Ryan, I know what you're thinking. Who is Luke Cage? Some might know him from a Netflix show. Well, I'm sure that this is about the same response as Arizona football. They did do something once upon a time when Rick Rod was there. Fun fact, Luke Cage also was known for beating Spider-Man, just like Washington has struggled down in Tucson in the past.
Do you know that one at all?
Not at all.
You don't know it?
No.
Okay.
Utah, Captain America. Give the little Steve some super soldier serum and he becomes a hero that can punch above his weight. Utah got their super serum when they joined the pack and has become a team that can punch above their recruiting class. Also, the Cap is best known for a shield, a.k.a. defense, just like the Utes. Okay.
All right.
Colorado is Hawkeye. Sure, he is part of the team, and sometimes he plays a part in the story, but at times he is nowhere to be found, just like Colorado. Kind of crazy that one of the founding members of the MCU didn't make it into the Infinity War movie. Oregon is Iron Man. He can go toe-to-toe with the strongest Avengers, not because he has the powers, but because he seems to have endless resources and a suit for every occasion. Also, Stark's inability to stop himself from pursuing or even recognizing dangerous ventures led to his downfall at some points. All
right. He wrote sweet for every occasion, but he meant suit, right?
I am a fluent reader of the English language. So I correct as I go. I'm not going to belabor the point. Not going to do it.
I didn't know if there was some suite of things that Iron Man had or something. Okay,
he's got a suite for every occasion. He probably does. He's a very rich man.
He does.
Oregon State War Machine. He gets Iron Man's leftovers. There have been some moments that War Machine gets the best of Iron Man in a fight, but normally he is always in Tony's shadow. All right, that works.
Is that his partner?
Sort of. War Machine is like his buddy in the military that he gives a suit to.
Okay. But they don't... They fight?
They've fought a couple of times. Fight with your friends. Stanford is Hulk, Bruce Banner. When Stanford is good, they have been seemingly unstoppable, just like the Hulk. Lately, they have been more Bruce, too smart for their own good. Okay? And Cal is Groot. Went back and forth on a lot of heroes for Cal. I ultimately ended up with Groot because as a superhero, he has a lot of potential but doesn't seem to utilize it unless he has someone or something to motivate him. For Cal, that someone is Chase Garbers. Thanks, Brad in Portland.
Nice, Brad.
Good stuff.
Again, someone that knows way more about that subject than I do, the superhero things. But good stuff. It made sense, the ones I know. This is Card Sharp Cook and Pac-12 Rookies for Dynasty NFL Leagues. In these Dynasty Leagues, you keep as much of your team as you want every year and draft the rest. So you're mostly drafting rookies. How do you rate the career chances of these drafted Pac-12 players? So NFL Dynasty Leagues. For tight ends, Colby Parkinson for Stanford and Devin Asiasi for UCLA. Wide receiver, Isaiah Hodgins, Oregon State. Patman for Washington State, Pittman for USC, Chenault for Colorado, and Ayuk for Arizona State. Quarterback, you got Eason, Luton, and Herbert, Washington, Oregon State, and Oregon. And for running back, Kelly from UCLA, Moss from Utah, and Eno Benjamin from ASU. Think about drafting for a career, not a season. Are they potential heroes, solid possibilities, or not worth the roster space? Which of these players have a chance to be a top 20 player within the next 4 years? Thanks, Card Sharp Cook.
So just like hearing the names, I think running back is probably the most stacked in this group. Like when I'm looking at them all, like what I think each of those three players, I wouldn't discount the possibility that they're like talked about as one of the best running backs in the league within a couple of years. I can't really say that about any of these other position groups. So, all right, let's go through them and rate them by these three things. So tight end, Parkinson and Asiasi, I think they're both solid possibilities. I don't think either one is potentially going to be like the best player in the league or best tight end in the league.
Yeah. I mean, I like Parkinson a lot, but it's just based on what it's hard to say. Like, even just looking at this whole list, I did some fantasy drafts. I don't think any of these guys came up except Zach Moss. I think he was a rookie running back that was drafted high, if I remember correctly. I don't think anyone was drafting anybody else. So that's at least initial potential, but he's talking about long-term potential. You know, Pittman's going to start for the Colts, I believe. I think, where's Hodgins at? I thought he might have been up there too somewhere. But I'd have to go look. I haven't even looked to see where these guys were drafted and, you know, what system they're in.
I don't know. I don't know at all. I'm just thinking about them as college players, where they might – what their talent might take them to. I mean, that receiver class, I think I've always liked Pittman a lot, and Ayuk, I think, will be good. Chenault's just had too many injury issues for me to know one way or the other with him. And he's a – he strikes me as a uniquely college player in just the way he was used. When he was at his best, he was being used in so many different ways that I just don't know that's going to happen at the NFL level. Nobody in that quarterback class excites me. I don't know. It's hard to rate any of these by these three categories without like knowing their situation very well.
All right, let me look real quick. There's rankings for fantasy football of rookies. This is good. They rank them all, actually. This is for ESPN. They rank them all. So going down the list, the first one I see is actually Brandon Ayuk for San Francisco. So they have him as a wide receiver 6. Zach Moss is 2 spots behind him. So Brandon Ayuk is the 11th ranked rookie. So that would be they're in Zach Moss. Pittman's 15, Chenault's 16. So they have that's pretty good group there. Let's see who else is on the list. Joshua Kelly's 30th. He's with the Chargers. Herbert's 35th, also with the Chargers. Asiasi's 39th. So all these guys this is pretty good. Eno Benjamin's 49th. Colby Parkinson's 51st. Isaiah Hodgins, 53rd. And I think that is it. So that's good. So of ranking all the incoming rookies, a lot of those guys were ranked, at least by – this is from Mike Clay, ESPN writer. So, but the top one is actually Brandon Ayuk. So they think he's got the chance to make the earliest impact. I think I would go – I think I would pick Moss. I kind of have a feeling about Parkinson. And I just like Isaiah Hodgins a lot. I think I'll go with him. So those would be my three I would pick.
I concur. Totally fine. Let's do it.
Really? Yeah. All right.
Beautiful.
But, I mean, good job picking those guys. Unfortunately, yeah, the only – Herbert's got a chance as far as, like – but Luton made a team. Luton, like, someone got cut for Luton. So he's like a – I forget where it was, but I definitely saw he made a team. So.
Great.
Yeah, we'll see.
Good for them.
You care so much.
I just – yeah, NFL man. All right, this is Chris from Seoul. Should the podcast adopt a team for the fall? Hey, guys. Big improvement last week not hearing Ryan stumble through an email. Wow.
Tough, Chris.
Just,
I think I've done pretty good. I think I've done pretty good today. I don't know.
I think you've been handling it. Politics are incessant right now. We could all use less of that and more football conversation. One, would you consider picking one team that is playing now, review their last game, and preview their next game, just to keep you guys from getting rusty? Like past years, no need to prepare, just Googling as you talk. pick a school in the FBS, one that shares some recruiting territory with the Pac-12, one that plays a significant number of games against Pac-12 opponents each year, perhaps one that is capable of beating USC, even one you already have a sound drop for. BYU is the only FBS team west of Texas playing this fall. Crazy, eh? Would you adopt them?
They look pretty good, and they had a fun offense.
Sure. I'll watch some BYU football this year. I'll commit to it.
They only have 8 games, though, so you have to, like, pick your, you know, the right ones. I think they only have, and they're, unfortunately.
Wait. I'm committed to watching BYU and Georgia Tech, right? Isn't it Georgia Tech? Wasn't that the pick for me?
You were Georgia Tech, yeah. I think you were Georgia Tech, and I was Pitt. That's what they
picked. You were either Pitt or Florida State, I think.
Okay.
Wasn't there some, like, USC, like, kind of down?
Oh, there was a Boston College or something, too. Cause
I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, pick a team. But I'll do Georgia Tech and BYU. Two, Wilner is now conjecturing a Pac-8 winter-spring football season if the California schools cannot navigate state-local rules. The only two can touch a football sort of thing. Could it get any worse for negative perceptions of the Pac-12/8? No. Right now is about
that's not happening. Yeah. That's not happening. Like that, I like Wilner a lot, but that just didn't make any sense. You know.
Yeah. All right. Rules that create unintended outcomes are not unique to California. When the Korea daily positives rose to 447 out of a population of 50 million, restrictions were tightened. Protestant church services were banned, but Catholic services were okay. Chain coffee shops went to takeout only, but independents were allowed normal in-store service. Restaurants could go full pre-corona dining in, no social distancing, except from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. when it was takeout only, perhaps designed to contain the vampire corona strain. Keep up the work, your loyal listener, Chris from Seoul. Yep.
That's, I mean, it's a good point as far as, like, the arbitrary way that restrictions are put in place. You can do this, but you can't do that. And I think, I'm sure every country has weird ones. Because there's politicians making the decisions, not, you know, politicians that talk to medical experts, then they make a decision on what they think would be best. But I can't see, an epidemiologist going, you know what? We got to shut down the Protestant churches. Catholic church is okay, but the Protestant church is no way. Like, obviously, there's some political bullcrap involved in that. But it's funny. It's interesting that it happens in other countries, too.
Yep.
All right. This was weird. This is, Keon in Mordor. I mean the Bay Area. That's actually good. Hey, guys, I don't have a question for you. I'm just writing in very confused after listening to last week's podcast. You read a question that was allegedly for me. And you even reiterated multiple times that the question came from me, but I never wrote that email. I never even drunk wrote that email. I had to double check. And no, there is no way there's another Keon out there who listens to the show. There are 55 of us. The odds of 2 Keons out of 55 listeners are lower than the odds of me guessing how to spell Hifliday's guy's name correctly in this sentence. He spelled it Hifliday, H-I-F-F. To be clear, if I thought it was a witty or memorable email, I absolutely would have said, not have said anything and silently taken credit for it.
It was another Keon.
But it's this. The Keon in this email is K-E-O-N in the Bay Area. And that one was like K-I-A-N maybe, or is that?
Yeah. But we know. So of our 55 listeners, we have carefully selected 17 Keons.
And there, it was not easy to find 17 of you guys.
No, and do know, even if you think you found our podcast naturally, we selected you. You understand that. We found you, we put this in your earballs, and now you're listening to it.
Yeah, but there are 2 Keons just spelled differently. And we might pronounce it wrong. I'm sorry if we did. Okay, I wrote all that, and then I thought of something to ask. What game this coming week is most likely to be canceled, postponed due to COVID between the time you record and the games on Saturday? We're already seeing games canceled a few days before kickoff this week, and it's only going to continue to happen since you guys are probably groaning out loud about how many random Group of Five and FCS games there are. Let's keep it to Power Three games only. Cheers, Keon in Mordor or the Bay Area. Okay, I like this. Let's look at the schedule.
Duke, Notre Dame.
Okay, so that one, let's see, we got Power Five. Okay, so tonight, like, we're recording this, and in about an hour and a half, the Miami game is supposed to kick off. I don't think that's going to be canceled. Louisiana Lafayette's playing Iowa State. It's like an early game. West Virginia's playing Eastern Kentucky. Syracuse and North Carolina. Kansas State and Arkansas State are on like the big noon kickoff because some other game got canceled. I don't think they're going to cancel that.
Duke.
Notre Dame and Duke, I think they're going to go through. You're going to pick that one that's going to get canceled?
Canceled.
I think I'm going to go... Like, so I think the two Power Five teams won't get canceled, Clemson, Wake Forest. It's going to be something more like Oklahoma, Missouri State. You know, like, what the hell is a Missouri State?
No, that's their $55 pay-per-view game. They're not canceling that.
Okay. UTEP, Texas. I don't think anyone wants to. What is an HBU against Texas Tech?
Don't know.
Maybe I'll do that one. It's a later game. It's a later game. I'll go HBU Texas Tech.
All right.
But there was a bunch. So, yeah, like the Fox big noon kickoff. They had a Friday game on FS1 that got canceled. And then their big noon kickoff game, I forget who it was, that got canceled. And so then they had to move whatever it was, the game I said before. So they had to move that game up. It was a Kansas State, Arkansas State. So Arkansas State's getting a lot of TV time. By the way, the state of Arkansas is doing really well early on this pandemic. But I think Duke, North Carolina, I'm sorry, Duke, Notre Dame is going to happen. They're playing at, you know, Notre Dame Stadium. I feel like that's going to go through.
Nope, sorry. I already picked it. It's not happening.
All right. It's done deal.
And you know I'm always right.
Yeah.
Never been wrong before on this show.
Never.
Not once.
All right.
Certainly not recently.
Certainly
not about anything pandemic related. Certainly not about anything related to the college football schedule. Never wrong.
No.
Not once.
No.
All right, this is from Alex from Arcadia. Deep thoughts. All right, guys, so I've been wondering this. Why are people so pissed at having winter spring football? If three other conferences make it through their seasons, if they do, doesn't the idea of having one season end and another begin sound awesome for football fans? Yeah, that's what we're saying. Exactly.
Yeah.
That could be really cool and fun. One other thing. If someone from the SEC sees that they aren't part of the two deep and they try to transfer to the Pac-12 or Big Ten, could they potentially play in the spring? Obviously, they'd have to be ruled eligible, but that seems like it's getting easier these days. Anyway, thanks for the time. Thanks for helping me get through my commute. And Dave, thanks for letting Ryan do it all. Stay safe, boys.
that'd
be interesting. But I think it would only work if they sat out, right?
I think if they played, everyone gets that bonus year, but I don't think you can use it twice. Like, that's essentially, you can't play in 2020 twice for two different teams. I think you could play in 2021, especially if you're like a grad transfer. But if it was a guy that maybe got hurt before the season started, or they had COVID and they were sitting out and they missed most of the season, and the Pac-12 announces they're going to have a season in the spring, and that player sees an opportunity, they could maybe not play and transfer and play, for the other school. Now, but you have to line up with, like, the semesters or trimesters, everything, right? You can't just, like, it's not about the season, too. It's about the academic year also. So it might be easier if the Pac-12 was, say, starting in January versus starting in November or December. Maybe December would be easier, but, like, if it's the end of a semester or the start of a new one, I think it would be easier to transfer as well.
Yeah.
You have to think of the academic side of things, too.
That's what I always do. That's what I always spend my time doing.
No, you do not. All right. Well,
that's
it. I think that's it.
We're done.
Very good.
A brisk, hour and 45 minutes.
It was there was some length to that one. There were some long emails and a lot of stuff to talk about. So I'm going to watch some college football this weekend. David will not, but hopefully you guys all get to watch some and give us your thoughts on what you saw. Like, does it work? Does it not work? Are you going to be more optimistic that the Pac-12 can play or not? We're curious of what you have to say and let us know.
All right. Well,
and with that,
great.
Let's wrap it up. I'm Ryan Abraham. That's David Woods. And we are the Podcast of Champions. Thanks so much for tuning in. And we will talk to you next time.
Bye.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.